I'm a real deal. I'll shoot your liver out and hand it to you.
Want to talk today?
Now it's going to work. Oh, yes, Rob, it's working. Isn't this fantastic?
Let's go, yes.
This is really nice. I'm very happy. I finally figured out how to get this to work. Now I'm going to stop moving the little, buttons around and messing with the volume. This is going to be fantastic. This is going to be such a great podcast from here.
Sometimes you just got to get it going, man.
It's going to be first, awesome.
You got to make that first ball and then everything unfolds like the petals of a lotus.
Yeah. Or like Demetrius and the VG10 2.0 with his break.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right. The break is like 50% of the game. The 1, 2, and 3 is like 40%. And then the rest of the balls are like kind of just routine, right?
Well, apparently.
I was just thinking about that today. Thinking about the difference between 8-ball and rotation games.
Yeah.
Eight ball gets tougher. Yeah.
Toward the end of the game, you hardly ever see a professional miss the 7, 8, or 9. But trying to get out of an 8-ball rack, the last 2 or 3 balls sometimes gets tougher.
That's a good point. It's
the only pool game that's a whole different animal. I think really.
And there's no way to and your defensive options get thinner and thinner and thinner.
That's absolutely correct. As you go. Your only hope is that you can hide behind one of your opponent's balls.
Right. Well, and then they can just tap off the back. But it's been since I've been a kid, we've always talked about, killing soldiers. You better be able to run the table because as you shoot the balls in, you're killing soldiers.
Oh, absolutely.
So sometimes when my buddy Josh and I would be at a tournament watching somebody like kind of start running the balls and kind of acting confused and not really being, it's clear that they're not going to be able to complete the run out, but they don't know what do, so they keep shooting balls. I don't know. We had some joke where we were talking about, like, I don't know. We just pictured them, like, they're putting the blindfold on their soldier, giving them the cigarette, putting them in front of the firing squad.
Oh,
one at a time. We just see them shooting off the soldiers one at a time. We're like, Henry, step on up, sir. We appreciate your service. We're going to need you to step right over there in front of that pole.
I'm going to throw a Fargo question at you. Kind of what do you think is a general number where all of a sudden you, from the beginning of the rack, you can identify how to get out of it?
I think that the fives, I feel like the 500s should be able to do that. Yeah.
Really?
Yep. I think that there's going to be, like, the higher you go, the more often it's going to go according to plan. But I would think that somebody that's in the 500s should be looking to run the
ball. I know all kinds of players who are high fives.
Yeah, I would push back on that, too.
580, 590. And they don't have a clue of what their fourth or fifth ball is going to be in the rack.
But then what that actually is that they're actually 620 abilities that have 520 planning, and then their actual output is 580. But it's like the only thing holding them back 40 points higher is asking a little bit more from themselves and putting a little bit more care. We'll get this thing rolling quick, but I just wanted to mention I'm going to be doing a video review with little Chris again. And he sent me, because this guy ran 3 racks without making an error. So Chris wanted my opinion on what the guy could have improved at. I mean, the guy never made a mistake, but what it came down to was the guy managed to stumble through these hard racks. But man, there was like, if he had put a little bit more care into planning out the first shot or two, it would have just been a whole lot easier. You know what I mean?
Sure.
He shot his way through the rack.
I
think you're in the 500, so you ought to be trying to play from the beginning.
So, Demetrius, is that your way of telling me that I'm kicked off the island with you and Lil Chris, that I didn't get asked and you did?
Not at all. He was supposed to do that one on his own. I invited myself. I said, hey, because he said, hey, look at this and let me know if you have any suggestions. And I'm like, you know what? Let me weasel in there. I got a few comments. And he's like, yeah, okay. So no big deal. We'll be doing more. That was one he was supposed to solo review.
I don't know. We'll see. I'm a little bitter about it, but that's fine. Seriously, don't worry about it. It's cool. Whatever. I got things going on and I'm busy.
Man, you got
and
18 online tournaments you're running.
I didn't have time anyway. So I didn't want to be asked anyways,
out to the East Coast, you've got you're going to be like running the Moscone Cup pretty soon. I mean, come on, man.
Oh, you're trying to get me in trouble with Emily? Ooh, oh my God, she'd rip my face off. All right. Let's jump in.
Awesome.
We do have a Patreon update. I don't know what it is, though. Oh, yeah, that's right. That 10-ball video that I promised about 16 years ago, I finally got it up. It's about 30 minutes long, and it breaks down everything that you need to know about the 10-ball break when it comes to actually planning out your paths of the balls. So I think it was a pretty good video. I'm going to say that no matter what, because if nothing else, I'm going to gaslight the heck out of you guys. If I tell you it's great enough, you'll probably start believing it. And if not, then I got nothing else because, I don't know, my content's average at best. So I'm just going to gaslight you till you think it's great. So let me know what you think about it as the Patreons, the 29, 30, something like that, Patreons that we have to the podcast. Of course, you guys are the most loyal listeners as well, so you're constantly tuning in right away. Let me know what you guys thought of it, and if there's anything else that you would like me to break down, because at the end of the day, I actually kind of had a little bit of fun with it. So it's a very easy thing to do. I don't know why it took me so long to do, but I finally got it out there, and it's not a very difficult thing to do, so I could do some more of these in the future. Just let me know if these are of interest, I guess.
Can I watch it?
You cannot watch it. You want to know why?
I have to be a Patreon.
You got
to
be a Patreon. Yeah, that's you got to be a Patreon.
What does that cost me?
As little as $5 a month.
Oh. Okay.
There you go. That's all you got to
do. I could just join for a year then, right?
You could just join for a month and see it, and then cancel and make me sad.
Well, I wouldn't do that.
Also, I should say, I believe we have a new sponsor. Or not a sponsor, a new Patreon. I'm just not really sure because it's weird. I've never seen this before. It says it's a cash something. I'm not totally sure what that means. But Ryan Walker, I believe, is a new Patreon to the podcast. So I want to thank you very much, Ryan. I don't think there's anybody. Yeah, there's nothing else in there. So thank you very much, Ryan. Welcome to the Patreon group and all of the fun stuff you get, like the Monday night lessons whenever they'll start up again. But until then, we're going to do some supplements and videos here every now and then that break things down. If you want to become a Patreon, you certainly can as well. All you have to do is go to patreon.com, patreon.com/queueitup. And all of the information will be there. Plus, you get some goodies for signing up as well. So, all right, we'll leave that one there. We can move on to, I guess, just shout-outs. There's really nothing else I want to get out of the way. Do either one of you guys have anything that you want to talk about in the beginning?
No, I'm good. And I'll tell you, I don't have a specific shout-out. I was kind of thinking about it, and I'm like, you know, I just appreciate the listeners. I'll just shout-out to all the listeners. So all you guys listen along. Thank you very much for tuning in and supporting the show.
Well, you should have shouted out to Josh for doing that sweet podcast last week with you. That would have been a good one.
Well, I'll, you know, I can work on my shout out game, man. I'm not very, but I got a little far away from the shout outs. All right. Okay. Who do you got, Rob?
I'll take one away from you then. Cause I actually have a couple. I have a friend of mine who played up in a pool tournament up in Superior at the Top Hat Tavern. And these are top amateur players that were playing in this tournament. There was Jamie Pluta from the Cities, Junior was up there. He won the tournament. And then there's a player from the Cities. His name is Rob Mattson, and I'm going to shout out to Rob. He took some time off from pool to be a husband and a dad and raise his girls, and he's back into it now. And 15 years ago or so, when he took a lapse from the game and went to take care of his home life, I felt personally when I played against him many times back then, and that he was the best eight ball player I had ever played against, amateur eight ball player. And I watched him play up there. I watched quite a few of the matches, and he lost to Junior in the finals, and it was a real good match. His best match that I watched was against Jeremy Fedkenauer. It could have been Hill. Jeremy made a little mistake. But my shout-outs to Rob for coming back and playing at a pretty high level quickly. So it was fun to watch him again because I enjoyed, at the time years ago, watching him play, also competing against him. I did that too. That's one of the shout-outs. The other one is doesn't necessarily have to do directly with pool, but definitely indirectly. And that's a shout out to Brandon Jacoby. And I've known Brandon since he was 12. Of course, he took over Jacoby Custom Cues from his dad, Dave. And my shout out isn't necessarily got to do with the cool cues they sell. It's got to do with the type of person Brandon is. And a lot of times when you see people that they're in businesses and they are successful, they become aloof. They become distant from the common player, the everyday player. This is not Brandon. Brandon embraces all players, all levels of players on a personal level, not from a higher plane being the owner of a very successful pool cue making company. Brandon is, he's extremely honest. He's genuine. He is humble. He's a hardworking person. He's generous and he's kind. All those things, you see people that have worked for him for since the beginning of the business. They haven't left. They're still there. They're there for a reason. They're there not necessarily because they need a job. They're there because probably because of Brandon and his sister and the other people that are involved in that business. So that's my shout out to Brandon just for being a good guy. Much more so than owning a company that sells pool cues.
I can echo all that. Brandon has always been the first person to, whenever I have an event or a stream or something like that, I go to Brandon and say, hey, are you interested in getting involved with this? He says, just tell me what I need to send and you got it. So, he's incredibly supportive of the stuff that we do here at the podcast. It's been really nice that he's never even thought about it, basically. If I ask him to sponsor something or if he wants to help out with something that's podcast related, his questions are never, what's in it for me? His question is just how much do you need and how much do you need and when do you want to buy? That's the only thing that he ever says. It's crazy how supportive of the pool.
He's a lot like his dad. And that is, I've never heard Dave or Brandon say a contrary word about anybody, any players, any organizations, nothing.
Yeah.
Everything that comes out of their mouth is positive.
Yeah.
It's cool to be around people like that. So I just want to thank Brandon for being that kind of person.
Yeah.
And he's a great father to his daughters and husband and all that kind of stuff too.
Yeah. I can echo that. All right. My shout out is going to be to all of the people listening to this podcast as well, Demetrius, but for a different reason. We went over 100,000 downloads to the podcast. It's actually about a week and a half ago now, but because I've been off for the VG10, I haven't really been able to, I guess, update that. But we went over 100,000 downloads. It's kind of neat, right?
Absolutely.
I don't know. 100,000 downloads, 100,000. Times this podcast has been listened to well over that now. Well, I shouldn't say well over that now, but over that now, it's pretty neat. It's a little humbling to think that there's that
so
many people
we're
out
famous?
There. We're basically big deals now. It's what I'm getting out of this. Did you believe any
it's
of that?
It's the pool hall famous, where you go into a pool hall and everybody knows you and they're excited to see you and they're high-fiving and asking you questions about your equipment and about this and telling you about that. And then you go next door to the gas station and you're nobody. That's the pool hall famous.
Well,
well, I don't even
think that happened for me when I walked into places where there were tournaments. All I heard was, oh, no, him again?
But I don't think that has anything to do with your playing abilities, Rob. Burn. All right, here we are. Okay, yep, that's I guess we're that's pretty much everything we got to get cleared up in the beginning. Let us jump into the podcast now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we are going with the Manscaped ad because that's what we do here. What's up, Rob? How you liking your Manscaped
package? I'll tell you what, you guys.
Package.
I opened up this packaging at Christmas time when everybody's opening their packages up. And I'll tell you what, your balls will thank you. And that T-shirt that was in there, I held it up, and everybody had a good time reading that. But this crop preserver and crop reviver, they are just really special items. And the one here, you know, it says about letting your package air dry. And I thought, well, gee, what are you going to do? You're going to stand there with your legs spread and kind of do the hip twitch thing and put a heater on it or what? No, and I thought of a better way. You take this little red spinning stool that you use to work on your car with. It's got the place to hold all your tools on the bottom of it before that spins around. You stand on it with one foot. You pull one of your legs up and hold it with your other hand. Push off the wall and spin around. And just let the package air dry.
Wow.
That's it. You know, and one thing that you said, Rob, is that, you know, when you first opened up the box, everyone that saw it was really impressed.
They were.
And you know, and I'll just tell you, when you're done using this, everyone will be equally impressed with the packaging, if you know what I mean.
Yes, I know what you mean.
Yeah. Oh, this is where we're at in life.
This is just the greatest little packaging I've ever seen. You got all these little Manscaped things in here and refining the gentleman in you. I mean, come on.
It's good stuff. Perfect. And now, on top of it, we have the crop cleansing body wash and the crop mops. How great are those?
The crop mop.
They're just great, you know? Well, as full disclosure, the Manscaped ad is not working very well as far as turning into product, apparently. So we are trying again with the body wash and the crop mops. So clearly, everybody loves listening to us talk about it and joke about it, but we need some financial support for the great Manscaped. We are here again doing the ads because they want to work with us in the future. We want to work with them. We want to continue having these fun jokes, these fun experiences, is that what we're going to call them? Of Rob getting to open his Manscaped Lawnmower 3.0 on Christmas Day in front of all of his family and getting to explain to them what the usage of this is. It's just great, you know? We got to have these opportunities. So if you want to get yourself a Lawnmower 3.0, you can do that. It is great, and it is now available in the UK. So come out of quarantine with cleaner balls thanks to the Lawnmower 3.0. This waterproof and skin-safe trimmer will reduce nicks to your two best friends. The third-generation trimmer even has a light to shine a light to the promised land, 2021.
I got mine on right now. My Lawnmower 3.0 is now running and the light is shining in my face.
It is also time to freshen up down there in the new year. The Crop Preserver is an anti-chafing ball deodorant and moisturizer. You already put deodorant on your armpits. Why not put deodorant on the smelliest part of your body? That's actually a pretty good question, isn't it? And for the on-the-go freshness, you'll love the Crop Reliever Ball Toner Spray. Start the new year with a fresh set of testes thanks to the Manscaped. Manscaped even threw in a shed traveling bag to keep all of your goodies stored comfortably. Speaking of comfort, Manscaped anti-chafing boxer briefs are also included and will bring your underwear game to the next level. Bring sexy back in 2021. Get 20% off plus free shipping with the code QITUP at manscaped.com. That's 20% off plus free shipping with the code Cue it up at manscaped.com. And what is the t-shirt?
Boxer briefs.
What does the t-shirt say, Rob?
Proprietary, your balls will thank you.
Your balls will thank you. All right.
Proprietary microfiber blend ensures breathability and repels moisture. Anti-chafing detailing with sweat-wicking fibers prevent chafing and swamp crotch.
Promo code, cue it up. All right, since the last time we had a podcast, I guess there's been some pretty big things that have happened. We've had a one-pocket matchup between Corey Duell and Justin Hall. We'll talk about that briefly because I didn't watch really actually all that much, but I had it on a lot of the time, but I wasn't really actively watching it. With the VG10 that I had to do and the work that I had to do to maintain that and keep that running smoothly, as well as the Fedor Gorse, because to be honest with you, I thought Fedor and Jeffrey DeLuna was a more interesting matchup personally. So when they were on, I was watching that more specifically
What was the final on that one?
Jeff and Fedor? Or...
Yeah.
Oh, we'll talk about it in a little bit.
Okay.
That'll be the next thing we talk about. But we'll start with this matchup. I guess the final score was 24-22. Is that right?
You know what? I'd have to look it up. I know that it was really, really, really close till the end, and I thought Justin won it. I didn't watch it, so that's just what my memory tells me.
Yeah, Justin won it. They actually went 4 days. It was supposed to go 3 days, but it ended up going 4 days. And it went into the fourth day, 21-22. So pretty close going into the last day, like you said. And Justin gets it on the last day. The only thing that I would say I really watched from that is it was exactly one pocket. So Chip Compton is pretty – I mean, when Chip and Roberto played, I mean, it was just so boring. It was like terrible one pocket. It's not like – it's basically just defense is what it was. And it was waiting for – Chip was waiting for Roberto to make a mistake and sell out. And then Chip would make three balls. And then he'd wait for him to sell out again. And then he'd make three balls. And then he'd wait for him to sell out again. And he'd make his last two balls and be done with it. And that basically lasted for like 10 hours a day. And it was like nauseating. And then
I just want to clarify, because you said that was bad. You know, Chip played well, but what the problem was is that Chip was just outmanning him to the point where it was very one-sided. And so you didn't really get to see much dynamic, you know, back and forth. You know, it was just kind of watching a guy get, you know, kind of get up against the ropes for 3 days and just a slow boa constrictor death. And so there wasn't much to watch in that sense, but Chip played well, but it was not a very good show in that sense.
It was just basically Chip kicking the can down the road until Roberto tried something stupid. So it wasn't really an interesting match personally. I mean, I watched a lot of it, but it just wasn't really interesting to me. But this one, from what I saw, it was right back to what it was. There was, you know, aggressive shots that, you know, aggressive defensive shots is what I like to call them. Actually moving towards, you know, trying to win position to finally get your opponent to break and having enough position to be able to get yourself out of the rack. And for the most part, it was like that all the way through. It was pretty good one pocket matchup. Like I said, none of us really watched it all that much. So I think you guys both had Corey winning, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I think that I picked Corey. I knew, well, my prediction was that it was going to be very, very close. I know it could go both ways. I picked Corey in the end just because I feel like his execution is just a hair stronger. And so when I know it's close, whenever it's going to be really, really close, I like to go with the guy that has the better striking. But yeah, I mean, Justin proved he can do it.
Yeah. Well, we'll probably leave it at there. I guess there's not really a ton to discuss because we didn't watch all that much of it. And I know we always get flack in the past for talking about matches that we didn't watch. And if you're one of those people, keep it to yourself, because the match that we really want to talk about, which we will, is the matchup between Jeffrey DeLuna and Fedor Gorst. And I will start this off. I believe the final was 100-66. It was just a complete beatdown. And before we even jump into the match, I want to talk about some of the things that happened, because Jeffrey DeLuna got a lot of flack afterwards, and in my opinion, rightfully so. He was doing a lot of really shady things, trying to basically make the match competitive, try to get into Fedor's head maybe, try to rattle him, try to do anything to give himself an opportunity to get back into the match. And a lot of those things were, he was breaking outside the box, and we're not talking like, I shouldn't say the box, outside of the kitchen, and we're not talking like an inch or like half the ball. He was like, there's photos online that you can find that he's breaking almost 2.5 balls outside of the kitchen. And he's not doing that to gain an advantage. Like there's no advantage really to breaking closer to the rack, really. I mean, maybe on the edges if you're trying to get if you're trying to control the arc of your cue ball and you're trying to maximize it with striking the rack with it, okay, fine. But 2.5 balls, no. Because if you're going to be breaking from 2.5 balls outside of the kitchen, you have to be doing it regularly to know that that's a break that works for you. That's not something that you just learn on the spot. So he's doing something, in my opinion, to basically try to shake Fedor. Now, there was also a situation where they played a match, or they were playing a game, and the commentators weren't in the booth yet. And basically, Fedor hits the rack, breaks him wide open, has an easy shot, and Jeff says, basically, as he's watching the commentators go back in the booth, that break doesn't count because the commentators weren't in the booth. I mean, these are just silly things, right? I mean, nobody with a rational mind is going to say that having the commentators not in the booth makes the the match invalid. It's not a commentary match. It's a pool match. And if both players are in their seats, ready to go, you don't need to worry about commentators. Like, that's just silly. And the fact that he's saying stuff like that, you can't say that and actually believe it, right? You can't. You're not that. Jeffrey DeLuna is not a dummy. He's not a dummy. He knows what he's doing. And he's always had some situations that happened in the past that I've, for the most part, overlooked. But I think at some point in time, with the things that happened in this match, when you're getting just your face beat in, I think it's time to have the discussion. Is Jeffrey DeLuna a shady player? Is he a bad player? Is he bad action? So I do want to start the discussion there based off of what we said. And, of course, there's been things in the past, so I won't go into those. But I think we need to have that discussion at this point in time because I think we owe it to the pool community to – I think that we actually have not a huge voice in the industry, but I would say between the three of us that our opinions are valued a pretty decent amount in the pool industry. And I think just like in all other aspects of sports, these discussions are very important, if nothing else – just for the act of informing and partially policing what actually happens in the game and the outlook on it. So why don't we actually start with that discussion before we even talk about the match? What do you guys think?
Go ahead, Demi.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, really weird because everybody grows up on their own culture and pool culture as to what's okay and not. But I think, so like if you're you know, if somebody comes out of a certain community in a certain area, maybe their etiquette there is a little different. And so there's always this question is like, what's part of the game and what's not part of the game? And this even comes up in poker all the time, you know, where poker, somebody's like, oh, I bet blind. I didn't look at my cards. But then they actually did look at their cards. Some people think that's really bad etiquette to say, well, you said you didn't look. And I thought we were just being sportsmanlike that you were just getting some action. But then the other player's like, but no, I'm just, that's poker. It's, you know, deception. It's part of the game and it's an act and you got to know. And it's like, so there's always these little things that come up as to what's considered part of the game and what's not. And so I can excuse some of that at the local levels with kind of cultural or kind of differences. But once you get to the world-class professional level, you're no longer part of your original community. And I don't know how it came, you know, down in the Philippines where he was playing in his home pool hall. But once you get to the world scene, then there's a new community. You're no longer part of your small community. Now you're part of this big, established pro community. And these days, that's kind of like, that's, you know, not really how we do it. You know, you just kind of, you let your stick to the talking, you play by the rules, and you just try to beat the other guy. And so he's not dead to me. I'm not like rooting against him or anything like that. I don't think he should be fined. I just think that, you know, somebody that's in his corner should kind of give him a little feedback and say, you know what, man, don't do that.
Yeah, that's really true, Demi, about where you grow up and what you're exposed to in the pool world as your game gets going. And what you learn and how you learn, the people around you. And I grew up in an era where, I mean, if your opponent could do or say anything he wanted to you while you were playing, there was no restrictions. There was no etiquette. It just didn't matter. So there is a difference with that. But, yeah, at the degree they're playing now, yeah. Well, look at the VG. Somebody just posted about the other guys calling fouls on themselves that nobody else saw that they could have got away with. And they didn't. They just gave table up, said, no, I fouled. That kind of thing is what we expect, I think, in this day and age, not the other way. And that's appreciated by players. I know I've done it. Handed the ball to a guy, and he goes, what are you doing? I said, well, I fouled. And nobody saw it. That kind of thing.
So what do you think should be done, though? I mean, I think we're all on the same page. Well, that's like not great etiquette. What is there? How should the pool world handle that? Like, how that, do we,
you know,
this is interesting.
It's like trying to change somebody's mind who has a certain political view. And
well, Rob, let me jump in because this actually touches in what I want to talk about this too. And you guys both kind of hinted at it when you were saying, when you're saying you're on the global stage, Demetrius, and then Rob, you're kind of saying like there's a professional type of oeuvre to pool where back in the day it doesn't really matter, right? I mean, it was treated as a game, as a bar game, really. So what right. happens in a bar? You talk to your friends. Maybe you do a little friendly shark, or maybe it's not friendly. Maybe it's a little bit more malevolent than that. But the idea is, it's there is no unspoken rules when it comes to pool. And I think with the professionalization of pool that has happened in the last, I don't know, maybe 5 to 10 years, really, I think a lot of this has been put into place by Matchroom. With the professionalization of the sport, you now have ethics that you have to follow. You have expectations of professionalism. The Euro Tour has an entire dress code that you actually have to dress nicely for an event. Of course, this used to be the case back in the day when we were on ESPN, because there is a level of professionalism that you need to represent as a player and as a promoter and as a referee, all that good stuff. There's an expectation of the player that comes with this. Now, if you want to talk about just old school bar pool, the Philippines is like, that's it. That's the Philippines. You watch some of these videos, and there are people. There are 150 people shoved in around this pool table, and they're less than a foot away from it. I mean, to the point where they actually move out of the way as the player encircles the table. I mean, that is exactly what you're talking about, Rob. When you're saying that, you know, you're kind of having friendly sharks in the bar with your buddies. That's exactly what this Filipino culture is. So I and this kind of goes to what you are talking about, Demetrius, is that stuff happens. That stuff works there. And when you're immersed in a culture that is constantly trying to shark each other, or, you know, cheering when you miss or whatever it is, Jeffrey DeLuna is playing the game as if that. He's trying to do whatever he thinks is necessary, in my opinion at least, to give himself some sort of edge off of the pool table mentally. And
I was really thinking about this. I'll let you finish here.
Go ahead.
I've noticed that there's some players that really it's like a lot, like the way I look at it is you play your game, they play theirs, and then what happens. But there are a lot of pool players I've seen that, like, they look at it like they're trying to get in your bubble. They're trying to make their presence felt. They're trying to – sometimes I know people that create controversies just so that they can kind of, you know, have a little confrontation and try to, like, kind of, you know, like almost like when you're walking to the table and they're walking away, they'll bump shoulders with you or something. Not like literally, but kind of like they're just trying to get a little bit of your space. Like, I'm here. You got to deal with me. You think, you know, you're not going to ignore me and just – yeah, I don't know, man. It's – There's players that really feel that that's a big part of the game.
Correct. And I guess that brings me to my broader point is there are people in all sports, whether it's golf, whether it's basketball, whether it's football, trash talk is part of the game and sharking is part of the game. But there is I'm perfectly okay with that for the most part. I mean, you got to keep it respectful. You don't start doing weird things, but you know, if you want to start doing some trash talking, I'm for the most part, I'm going to be okay with that. But when you start leaving the rules that are in place that both players need to follow, like breaking outside of the box, if Jeffrey DeLuna wants to call this break didn't matter because the commentaries weren't in the booth, all that is that's exactly what that's a shoulder check on the way back to the chair. It's not going to get you anything. It's not going to do anything productive. All it is to make your presence known. It's a, hey, I'm here and you have to deal with me. Like you said, Demetrius, it's nothing more than that. But the idea that he's going to start going outside the rules to try to give himself an advantage or to try to create this type of shoulder check per se by breaking out of the box, now you're leaving what's legal within the game of pool, and you're no longer – now all you're doing is you're being a shithead. I mean, for lack of a better term, you're being a shithead.
Exactly. You're starting to do things like when you're breaking outside the box, it's like, I'm going to do a deliberate foul just to make you have to have a confrontation with me to stop me from breaking the rules. And I'll tell you what, and this is not this is very common, so I'm not going to get a universal agreement here. One thing that I'm really fatigued with is the slow concession. If I see it, I get so tired of watching it where a player misses And then they just kind of sit there with their cue stick over the rail, and they're just kind of like looking at disgust at the ball they missed. And if the other guy's already walked to the table, they're waiting for the guy to leave so they can get down and shoot. And the guy's just sitting there pointing and dragging, and he slowly drags his cue at half a mile an hour off the table and slowly walks away to his chair. It's like, gosh, man, it's like the slow concession. I just find it really, really, really disgusting. And it doesn't shark me. I just, players like that, there's a special place in hell for the slow concession.
Yeah, you missed. Get the comment about, you mentioned the space thing, Demi.
Yeah.
That you have your space at the table when you're playing, correct? I mean, that's it. You've got 3-4 feet around the table that belongs to you if you're the shooter. Doesn't belong to anybody else, doesn't belong to your opponent. And I can remember out in Vegas watching the pros play 1 year, and I watched Earl play out there 1 year, and before every match, he would take and move his chair that he was sitting in away from the back of the viewer area where the people sat.
He'd get closer to the table?
About a foot. He pulled his chair out about 12 inches every match. And I told the guy I was sitting next to, I said, watch this. Watch what Earl does this match before he starts the match. He pulled his chair about a foot out. And then when he sat in his chair, he leaned back in his chair and stretched his legs out, full length.
Yeah.
So that when that his opponent came around the table on that end, they had to go around his feet.
He
purposely encroached on their space on that table every single match. And I looked at that and I went, well, can he do that? I guess he can. Nobody's telling him he can't because he's still doing it. One of the people he played said anything about it.
I want to make sure that Nate's point doesn't get diluted, because Nate has a really, really important point, which is those things are not cool, but when it's deliberately breaking rules, like breaking out of the box or accusing the guy of having a ref not count when we know it counts, when it comes to, you know, there is a difference between kind of being a little sleazy versus being kind of like – illegal.
One's trash talk and one's just being a sketchy player.
Yeah.
One's trash talk and one's not. I mean, one goes over the rules and one's trash talk. So finish out.
No, my main point. The only thing to the listeners, when people do that stuff to me, by the way, because this stuff happens, I don't like it. I wish that we just all play the game and whatever, but there are people that are going to do that, and so you can't let the terrorists win. Like, in my opinion, when people do that stuff, you can't let it become effective, because otherwise you're rewarding that behavior.
Yeah.
So what my move is that I just, like, I'll just take time. Like, if the guy's going to do a slow concession, if I go to the table and he's slow conceding, I'll just go back, wipe off my cue, have a drink, take a 30-second break. And now he's going to get impatient with me, like, well, hurry up and shoot. And it's like, well, you know, now then don't do that to me. And if an Earl were there and stretching out his legs, then I would just walk by and I just kind of like, you know, either I just say, excuse me, and I stare at him. And then I take 30 seconds to regroup so that I wasn't sharked. And every time he did that, I would excuse myself. I'd make a point of walking by there, excuse me, come through, and then I would take 30 seconds to regroup. And you know, let's see who's gonna get fatigued to doing that. So
nobody did that.
That stuff stand. But here's the thing, to Nate's point, in a tournament, I gotta play whoever I gotta play. However, I choose not to play matches with people like that. So there are people I know that behave in a way to where I'm going to have to come prepared with a strategy of how to handle their maneuvers. And I just don't play guys like that. Life's too short. I don't need the action. I'll just play who I want to play. Seriously. So
I've actually not gone to tournaments where there's certain people that are going to play in it.
Mm.
I just won't go play in it.
So long story short, to get back, yeah, I think the answer is yes. I think that I don't hate Jeff DeLuna. I'm willing to kind of see how he handles himself in future matches. But, yeah, I don't think that's good behavior. So,
I mean, the last two memories I have of watching him actually on the table was this match against Fedor, where, let's be frank with it. We're going to talk about the match a little bit. But, I mean, let's be frank. He got beat up on, and his response to it was trying to be as shady as he could possibly be to try to throw Fedor off his game because he couldn't compete with him on the table. The last memory I have besides that was him playing in the Predator what was it, the whatever the one pool event was that
with
they had.
The pattern racking issues,
yeah,
right?
where he was pattern racking. And I said this at the time, like, he was breaking the rules. The problem that I had with it was there was another rule that was broken that basically wasn't enforced. And I said, if you're going to call it on Jeff DeLuna, you better call it across the board. And they didn't do that. But basically, Jeffrey DeLuna was working outside of the rules there, too. He knows that you cannot he knows that you cannot pattern rack. And he basically switched, when they called him on it, he switched to a different rack and did that one every single time. And then once they called him on that, he switched back to his original one. The idea is, like, you're working outside of the rules. You're doing exactly what you shouldn't be doing, knowing that you shouldn't be doing it. And you're doing it basically just to stick a finger in the eye of whoever's running the event and saying, like, I don't care about your rules. This is how I'm going to play. And if it's outside of, you know, basically he's putting it on the tournament directors to make a call. They did. He didn't like it. So those are the last two memories I have of Jeffrey DeLuna. Both of the times he is working outside of the rules to try to give himself an advantage. And at some point in time, you got to stop. You got to get called out for it. And I think that's what our job is.
And one thing I think is really important to point out, it's in a lot of competitive sports, people almost have to do stuff like that to compete. Like, for example, if you look at like cycling, you know, of course, like everybody's using some type of enhancements and blah, blah, blah. And if they took the medal away from, you know, Lance Armstrong, and it's like they gave it to the next guy that like was actually tested clean, it was like guy number 29 would get the trophy. You know what I mean? But in pool, I just want to make it clear, like our best players, Shane doesn't do that. You know, Filler doesn't do that. Federer Gorst didn't do that. So it's like when you look at the actual guys winning world championships and the guys that are at the top of the game, you know, there's no such in pool. It's not like the top 20 players are all throwing elbows at each other. And that's just what you have to do to win. That's not the case. Our top 20 players mostly play extremely clean. And so therefore, it's not necessary.
Yeah, it's the second. Yeah. It's the second tier players, and I get that. I get that this is you know, this is his livelihood. This is what he has to feed his family with. I totally get that. I totally understand that. The point is if you cannot make a living at what you're doing without cheating everybody else around you, maybe you should probably be in a different career. And I don't take any pleasure saying that, but I think Jeffrey DeLuna is plenty talented enough to compete with the second tier professionals, not the, you know, the Shanes, Jason, Joshua Filler, Fedor Gorst, but the next tier, the Naoki Ois, the Alexander Kazakis, the Neil's fine at this point in his career. I mean, that second tier of players, I think he can compete with those guys just fine. But if you're going to try to kind of cheat to try to make yourself belong with the top tier, I mean, we have to call you out. I think it's our job at this podcast and having a voice in the industry to call out the shady behavior that we see. And that's why we started with this before we even went to the match. So let's wrap it up there. I think we had a good discussion on that. And I think it had to be had. As much as it's not great to have conversations basically for more or less crapping on professionals, but I think, you know, there has to be ramifications for your actions. And I think that what we discussed there was important. So let's actually move on to the match itself. Like I said, it was about 166. Some of the takeaways I had from there, I'll start it off. The break. I mean, the Fedor's break is just – he didn't even break the balls good most of the match. He didn't even break them good. But there's a difference between Shane not breaking the balls good, Fedor not breaking the balls good, Tyler not breaking the balls good, and somebody like Alex Kazakis or Jeffrey DeLuna not breaking the balls good. Because when Jeffrey DeLuna and, you know, the rest of those kind of tier professional players don't break the balls good, they break dry or they scratch. When Fedor doesn't break the balls good, he makes two balls and gets hooked, like, consistently. Or he's not controlling his one ball, but he made three balls. Like, and when you're still getting the first opportunity at the table, you control the table. And if you're not getting your first opportunity at the table, all you're doing is playing catch-up from there and hoping that your opponent makes a mistake for you. And that's what I saw. The most important part of this match was Fedor didn't even break the balls necessarily that good the entire match, but his bad is better than Jeff's good, really. I mean, that's what I got out of that match. I don't know. What do you guys think?
Well, I'm looking at the break stats, and out of 99 break shots, he had a successful break, meaning he pocketed a ball and did not foul, 88 out of 99, and he ran out 43 from the break out of 99 breaks. So he was a 43% break and runs percentage, which,
is that good?
By the way, That's right there with what Jason Shaw, Shane Van Boning, and Tyler Steyer. Tyler was at 40%. I think the highest break and run percentage we see in a race to 40 in a race to 100 was like 44, 45. I think that was Shane. So the bottom line is that you know, and plus the reason this is interesting too is that a lot of people had questions like, oh, what if Shane played so and so? What if Shane played so and so? My contention at this point, and you know, nobody loves Shane at the peak of his career more than me, but you know, Shane was dominating people because he had a 40 plus percent break and run percent edge, whereas other people were breaking, running like DeLuna was 35%. He ran 24 out of 68, and that 8%, that's an 8-rack spread, and really, you know, it could be bigger. So the bottom line is that Shane always had a 10 or 15% break and run edge where he just was getting too much of a head start, and then that put too much pressure on his opponent in all parts of their game. Nowadays, I think in these races to 100 at the highest level, I think that you don't even show up without a 40% break and run percentage. And when people have that, the only people who could play them are people that have that same, you know, stat. Same thing with Filler and Aranis. I mean, it's the same thing. It's like you don't even have to look further than the break. The match is already decided by the break. You can't have a breaking deficit against the top player and play him a watch set.
Yeah, I think that's pretty good analysis. I pretty much echo everything. Rob, did you want to jump in for anything?
No, I echo all that. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And I don't like matches where they don't have where they alternate the break. That bothers me. That just makes that factor that you just talked about even bigger.
Yeah, when you're doing a bad
break and run a six pack.
You gotta
alternate the break, you can't do it.
Yeah.
No, I enjoy the winter break and I like packages, but I will tell you this, guys. When I think that what I said about you can't have a breaking deficit and expect to have a chance against a top player, I think that's too bad. I would like to see it to where the break
I agree.
You know, like in a fight you have like the reach and the striking and the grappling and all these things. Well, it's like I would like to see pool to where there's like who, you know, it used to be like back in the 90s when it was like Efford versus Earl. You'd be like, well, you know, Earl's got the breaking edge and maybe he's got the jump shot and maybe he's got, you know, some strengths when it comes to firepower and stroke shots. But then Efren's got the moving and the kicking game and the cue ball edge. So who's going to win? It's like you've got pluses on both sides of the check boxes. And nowadays, I feel like the breaking, if somebody has a breaking edge, then there's no skill set that can offset that. To make it, it's just insurmountable. And I feel like, unfortunately, I think that with how, you know, we went to 10 ball back in like the early 2000s to get away from the break becoming solved and becoming so dominant, you know, because what happened is Corey Duell solved the break with the corner ball when the one was on the spot.
The eight ball, so, yeah.
So we started going to 10 ball thinking that that was going to diminish the role of the break to where we could actually like focus on playing pool and having pool skills decide the outcome. I think that the break becomes disproportionate when it can't be overcome, you know, and I don't mind it being an important shot, but I would like to see, I think that the template racks and the fact that the 10 ball break has evolved to this point to where people are 90% successful to get control of the table, playing specific shots and then running out at a 43% clip. I think it's too bad. I would like to come into a match and have it be, I would like to have our analysis be about how they're going to actually play and who's going to win the most grappling games and who's going to be able to withstand the heat as opposed to who's going to have the better break stat. Because I just think that it's 10 ball didn't do its job if we're still talking about the best breaker's going to win.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, I'd say the only, I guess, exception to that would be when Dennis played Shane in the 9 ball. And that was, I mean, everybody who watched that match knows exactly what happened in there. I mean, Shane is up 113 to 96 because of the break, basically. And then, I mean, Dennis catches a gear and his break starts working really well for just a small amount of time. But that's enough to basically get him to a 120 to 119 victory. I mean, that's the only time that we can really point back, at least in my recent memory, where the obvious poor quality breaker want a match, and that's basically because it's, you know, the nine ball, and nine ball's a lot easier to break. It's a lot more of an equalizer break. Yeah, plus it's the nine on the spot. It's a weird,
because if you look, actually broke, by the end of the match, Shane broke better than Dennis at the beginning of that match, but Dennis broke better than Shane at the end of the match. And what was cool about nine on the spot is that you have to cut break, and it makes it so that cut break is so much more difficult to control, the balls, to control the cue ball, and to try to get shots on the one. It's such a hard shot that even when Shane had that big lead, at the end he was struggling with his break, and it made it easier for him to dog it off to Dennis than if he, you know. So I actually think, I'm not saying, I think I like the nine on the spot. I think that's a tougher game to run racks. Like, I would be surprised if they had a 43% run out stat with nine on the spot, because you'd be like, oh, there's more balls with 10 ball, but not really, because if you're breaking in 2, 3, 4 balls, then not really. So I think nine on the spot has gone a long way to be difficult. It's, you can't guarantee any certain ball every time. It's a little bit tougher to get the wing ball, and when you do, it's easy to lose the cue ball and come up with hard shots on the one. Now, I'm not saying that the Europeans don't have it cracked, but I think that nine on the spot is a better game than 10 ball in terms of demanding a full and, you know, a rounded skill set. I think there's more tough shots on the one, more safety battles, more. But I still like to see a little bit more congestion. I don't have the answer. I'm just pointing out, I think the role of the break is still a little bit imbalanced in 10 ball. That's all.
Yeah. Nope. I agree. I guess other than that, like I said, the match was a complete beatdown. I think at one point in time, Fedor was up 11-0 and 15-1. The day one ended up like 35-26. So I think DeLuna battled back a little bit, but that's basically what it was. Fedor jumps out right away, and by the end, Fedor's getting 3-2 and making a small comeback, but I think the end of the day two, he was down almost 20 games, and it's basically just only snowballed from there. So as far as the match itself, I think the only thing that's really interesting to talk about was, again, the break becomes so important, and then Jeffrey's antics. So I would say...
I have one other addition. I think that it's very educational for me anyway. And, you know, it goes to show the difference between, like, money games and tournaments sometimes. So I was actually impressed with DeLuna. Because on day one, like you said, he was down like 11-0. He fell behind by 13 at one point. He finished day one down 35-29. So he was only down 9 at the end of the day, which means he was still fighting really hard. And then day two, he was down 16 racks at 70-54. And then what that means is that the last at 70-54, he traded racks with Fedor for a long time. I guess maybe I'm looking at the wrong milestones, but I think what I looked at was that Fedor got a big lead, and then despite the fact that Jeff was getting outplayed, he had, you know, very, very little chance of coming back. He split racks with Fedor for a long time in the middle. Now, we could sit there and say, well, Fedor might not have had the same sense of urgency once he's up, you know, 10, 15 racks. He might just be satisfied to maintain the lead. But I'll tell you what, man, there was a 44-rack stretch where Fedor and DeLuna got 22 of them, and that was after being down like 15 racks. And to me, that shows a lot of fight. It shows a lot of heart. It shows a lot of fight. And what the lesson I took from that was, you know, because he gave Fedor a chance to do what Dennis did to Shane. He gave Fedor a chance to flinch and to be like, wow, what do you got to do to beat this guy? You know, you get him down 15 racks, you outplay him 2-1 the first day. You know, like, how do you, you know, what do you got to do to get this guy to give up? And the answer is they don't give up. I mean, I will tell you, these Filipinos, they're one of the things they do. I mean, it's like legend status, right? We all know that they have heart, but they really don't give up. And what that does is it really puts heat on your opponent. So my advice to anybody listening is when you're playing somebody and you know that the only way you're going to be able to win is if they break down and give it to you at some point. If you can do your job and keep fighting and keep delivering your game and keep winning the racks, you can win. It's so easy to give up when you know the only way I can win is if they just give me the set. I can't, there's no way I can force a win anymore. I'm too far behind. They're playing too good. But if you can continue to do your job, first of all, you give them a chance to make that mistake and let you back in the set. But secondly, you even encourage that mistake, because when you don't give up and you keep putting those racks together, it does put a ton of pressure as the front runner to where you're like, how come they're not giving up? How come they're not conceding? How come they're not, how come they're still fighting? And I'll tell you what, Fedor did not do that, but we've seen Shane do it. We've seen many top players do it. And the only reason it didn't work for DeLuna was just because of exactly how good Fedor is. If Fedor had been anything other than exactly who he was, I mean, of course it looks obvious when he keeps going and breezes to a victory, like, well, that was what was supposed to happen. But most players that played as good as Fedor on day one that got that type of lead would not have responded that well to how DeLuna keep, you know, nipping at his heels for 44 racks in the middle. And so I was impressed by DeLuna for not giving up and for putting that kind of heat on Fedor. And I was just as impressed by Fedor for transcending that. And it looks obvious when it goes that way, but I actually think that's a pretty impressive display on both their halves.
Yep, I agree. All right, Rob, say hi. Yes, you sir. Haven't said anything for a while.
I'm just sitting here getting educated.
All right. Well, we will move on from that. Let's move on to, I guess, the VG10
now. I got
a
question for either one of you guys, though, to get a little personal. Have you ever been in a match let's just pick 9-ball or 8-ball, whatever, but a race to 7, alternate the break where you've been down by your opponent's on the hill and you have zero?
And I've been in a spot.
You've won that match?
I've been in a spot twice. I've been down 7-0 in a race to 8, alternate the break.
Yeah.
And I've been down 7-1 in a race to 8, alternate the break. And I've made those two comebacks where, yes, my opponent had to, like, either come up dry or run 7 balls and hook himself. But exactly what I'm saying is, like, you know, I'll run a rack, they come up dry, I run out, I break and run another rack. And next thing you know, they're breaking and getting opportunities, but now all of a sudden, you know, they can only run 6 balls and things are going their way and they don't understand why this match is even over, not over yet.
Right.
And, you know, and it's only happened to me a couple times, but those were big sets when they happened.
Well, it's not going to happen often when you're playing a good player, that's for sure.
Well, I mean, those guys were both people that did that were, they were both, you know, I don't know if they were 700s, but they were both, you know, over 650, you know what I mean? They were both good players and, you know, yeah, that can happen. So, I mean, I've also lost matches, to be fair, where I've been up. I remember being up 4-0 in a race to 5, alternate the break, and, you know, did not win that match.
Sure, but there's nothing really more personally gratifying than being down. We have your opponent on the hill, and you need 6 games to tie them, and you win the match. I mean, it's like almost unheard of when that happens, and it's just you're kind of in a tither after it happens, like your head's spinning. Wow, how did I get home in this match, you know?
Yeah, momentum can shift, man.
It and
when
is
momentum,
momentum
starts shifting, you know, that's what I'm saying. Like it takes a really, really – the thing about Fedor and these really, really top elite 800 players is, like, they tend to play – they can play so good that even when the momentum is shifting around and the pressure is shifting around, they can usually hold it together. But once you get to, like, any kind of, like, less than professional level where it's, like, you know, anything that's at a local, regional level, nobody's immune. If you can get the momentum to turn around, anything can happen, you know?
Yeah, the top amateurs even, you know, you can see that.
Well, it even happened to Shane. I mean, if it can happen to Shane, it can happen to anybody.
Sure.
All right, let's...
Yeah,
let's
in the right circumstance, like a Moscone Cup.
Yeah. All right, well, let's move on to the VG10, I suppose. Demetrius, congratulations, you made the playoffs. Would you like to talk a little bit about it?
Yeah, I'll tell you, that was a big... I mean, that was a very big deal to me. You know, it's on paper... You know, I've thought a lot about why this was so meaningful. Of course, for those that don't know, I played the first VG10, and, you know, I was the worst breaker in the field. It's you're playing the ghost, the 10-ball ghost. I got to assume that nobody knows any of this. So 10-ball ghost, you have to break, but you have to make a ball on the break. And then if you do, you get to take ball in hand and try to run the table. And the first time I played, out of 27 breaks, I probably came up dry 22 times or something like that. I mean, I only gave myself one or two chances up set to 9, and that put so much pressure on your runout game that basically I was just breaking dry and raking the balls all day long in front of a crowd, and it was pretty miserable. And so that happened like 3 or 4 months ago, and I put a lot of work in. So for those that have been loyally following our podcast, you guys have heard me talk about the importance of the break. as not just important, but career defining. You've heard me talk about some of the things I'm doing to practice the break, some of the things I've learned about the break from Nate, from Little Chris, from watching others, like, for example, Jeff DeLuna, who's got one of the most powerful breaks in the world, and yet he's breaking 17 miles an hour with a flat cue ball. So, like, these are things I'm studying and I'm watching, and things like Nate's talking about with on the Patreon with the ball paths and all these things, how to get in certain balls to beat certain kisses. Like, these things are – it's I don't like that this is the most important part of our game, but it is. And so if you're going to play 10 ball, you have to put in this work. And so I did, and I've gotten better. And so anyway, I broke 24 times on last week, and I made a ball without scratching all 24 times, which it's almost like I don't really believe that that happened.
You know what I mean? That's weird. Quite remarkable, actually.
Yeah. And then I'll tell you what though, I also ran out 15 racks off those breaks.
Was that on your table at home? You did that?
Yeah, 9-foot diamond.
Okay.
And so I had, running out 15 racks. And I'll tell you some of the things. So besides the break, which is really, really, unbelievable. But then beyond that, I'll tell you, I played really, really solid. And so I did not miss. I went back and looked, and it's like, I never missed a 10 ball. And I thought about it. I'm like, well, geez, out of 15 10 balls I shot in, 14 of them were unmissable. Like 14 of them, I basically had ball in hand shape. One time I ran into the 10 ball, I had to cut it kind of thin on the side. But other than that, I looked at my runs and I'm like, I never really choked where I dogged off an opportunity. And my cue ball and my patterns were rock solid. My cue ball was rock solid. I think I hooked myself like two or three times. There was kind of a fumble. One time I jumped the ball and it recovered. Thank you, Nate, for helping me with my jump shot. But I hooked myself that ran to a dead end one time. And then I missed a ball that was kind of like a ball that it was even a half tough six ball. But like really, when I look back, it's like I played, I broke 24 times. I ran out 15. I really feel like I only missed one ball that was like really like, oh man, how did I miss that? And then I only hooked myself once where I felt like it was a really big blunder. Other than that, I had, a few racks that were just really, really difficult, but I didn't do anything super flashy, but that's kind of my style. I just did what I could do really, really, really steadily and solid all day, and didn't really make any fumbles. And so between generating 24 opportunities and not really making any fumbles, that got the job done,
Well, yeah. If you have a solid cue ball, you ain't going to have to do anything flashy. What you want your opponent to say is he's no good. He had all easy shots.
That's exactly right. And yeah, that's exactly right. I don't like to hear nice shot. And so I felt like I delivered my game. And then it's, it was tough. And I was wondering, why is it such a hard format? And I think I realized why. It's because in a double elimination tournament, when you're playing a human in a double elimination, you can get a good draw, or you can have your opponent where they either turn in a bad set or you get freewheeling and just beat one guy. And next thing maybe you get a good draw and then you freewheel and get past the world champion. Next thing you're two matches in. So out of 32 players, you're down to the final 16, down to the final eight, boom, you're 9th through 12th. And all you did was, get a good draw and then freewheel and kind of like sneak past one champion. And maybe when you were playing that guy, maybe they just dodged one or two eight balls and gave you a couple easy racks. And then you could kind of get the momentum going and get a lead and outrun the nuts against the chopped player. So it's like, I've done that many, many times in pro tournaments where I get down to the final, if I'm playing in a 32 man tournament, I get down to the seventh, eighth, fifth, sixth. And it's like, I did well, but it's like, it wasn't nearly as hard is getting to where I'm at now, which is the top 12 spots in this field of 32. And I'm like, well, why is this so much harder? And I thought about it. It's because unless you exactly win your division by winning all three matches, which, I was playing Niels and Fortunski, and Fortunski is just a run-out machine, and nobody took a set off him. So that means that in order for me to advance, I have to not only do I have to be second in my bracket, but I have to edge out all this other second place of all the other brackets. And so it's almost like you're playing a golf tournament with 32 players and you have to finish in the top 12 for your overall strokes to advance, where you can't just have one guy that you can't just beat the guy you're playing. I actually felt like I was competing against 20 other players, and you know, because even if 10 of them dog it off, even if the guys I'm playing dog it off, that doesn't even matter. I still have to beat guys in other brackets that aren't dogging it off, because I can't sit there and hope that 20 players dog it. You know what I mean? Like maybe 5 of them do, maybe 8 of them do. So in other words, I have to outperform the 12th best player in the tournament. That's what I have to do. I have to outperform the 12th best player in the tournament. And it's not enough to beat the guys in my bracket or to beat the guys that are having bad days. And nobody can give you anything. Nobody can dog anything to you. You have to earn it all from the one ball, from the break. And so it's like, it was one of the most difficult tournaments I've ever played. That's what I'd say.
Well, that's the way we wanted it to be.
There you go.
That's the way we wanted it to be.
So there.
All right.
Nice job, Demi.
Thank you.
So along with Demetrius, the number one overall seed goes to the player who won his pool, Miensko Forchunski. The second overall seed goes to Jean Salim. The third overall seed goes to Konrad Shushishkin. And the fourth overall seed goes to Nayuki Oi. Now, all four of those players get a bye into the quarterfinals. So that means that there are 8 players remaining, and they are all going to be playing the first round matches. So the first match that's going to happen on February 1st is going to be a match between Jim Telfer and Alex Kazakis. Match number 2 is going to be between Ivan Maluto and Albin Ocean. The winner of that match plays Miensko Forchunski. The winner of the first match, Alex versus Jim, plays Jean Salim. Match 3 will be Mika Immonen versus Demetrius. The winner
here
of that,
we go.
Yep, the winner of that will play Konrad Shushishkin. And the fourth match, which will be matches 3 and 4 will be on February 2nd. The last match will be between Wojtek Szewczyk and Kelly Fischer. Winner of that plays Nayuki Oi. So,
and how many racks did Nayuki Oi score to advance with the seed?
I think he had an 18.
Wow. It's so impressive, man. I mean, these guys play. It's just a really, 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 really strong to be scoring 18 racks. It's almost unfathomable to me, because I mean, I literally couldn't have broke any better. I mean, 24 out of 24 will never happen again in my lifetime. And then I backed it up with about as solid as I could play. And I mean, it was kind of the top of my range with the most opportunities I could ever create. And it was like, I got the 15 and I felt like it was almost like a lifetime achievement to do that. And for these guys to just be able to pull, you know, jump up and do 18 or higher, it's, I don't know, man, it's pretty darn impressive.
Yeah. Well, you have now taken down Niels already, and you're going to get the opportunity to take out Mika Immonen now. You're basically taking out this was your bet for so many years.
That's right. Niels versus Mika. Well, and I've never played Niels before. I do have a set where it's on YouTube where I beat Mika out in Turning Stone 9-4. So unfortunately, that means that, you know, I mean, he's not going to take anybody lightly at this point. But Mika's just he's just so powerful. He's always tough. But this format, again, it's going to come down to it could come down to firepower, especially if I don't play well and I'm missing balls and failing to execute. Well, then it's going to come down to firepower. But I'm still sweating the break. Some people might think, well, now you've got the break solved, but it's like, no, I don't feel that way. I'm still just as nervous as I was coming into this. We're playing 2 out of 3 races to 4. Like if I have 4 legal breaks versus if I have 2 legal breaks out of 4, like it's a ton of pressure on every strike on those breaks. And you have to strike with a firm stroke with accuracy. Boy, man, it's just like anybody that's played bar table 8 ball and it's hill. It's like that break shot. There's sometimes just all you can do is picture the ball flying in the side pocket. You know what I mean? It's just so brutal. And it's like that every break. It's like that, man. It's so tough. So I'm sweating it. I'm nervous, but I'm having fun. And, you know, I'd love to figure out a way if I can. I'm going to be putting in some work with the new pattern because, yeah, if I'm not expecting this or even optimistic that this will happen. But if I can get to a spot where I can keep cracking open the rack, if I can keep batting, you know, 90% plus on the break and spread it out with a good layout, well, then in this format, you know, I have a chance to to make a run. So I could easily break dry a couple times or just choke a few times and lose to Mika before I even get going. But I could also kind of figure something out with the break to where, you know, I could find myself, you know, getting deep into this thing. And either way, it's going to be fun to find out what happens. So.
Yep. I agree. I think we're going to have a lot of fun with this. Yeah, like I said, this starts February 1st. It goes all the way through to the 6th. I guess we can wrap our discussion of this up
there. Tell them where to find it. You got to follow Cue It Up Billiard Podcast, Cue It Up Podcast on Facebook. Nate's live streaming this on Facebook. Just make sure you find Cue It Up Podcast and put a like on some of his posts, and you'll see his updates, and you'll get to watch some of these matches next week.
If you haven't liked and followed my page yet, oh my goodness, I'm going to just going to snap if you haven't done this yet. But it's okay. That's where you can find it. All right. I guess with that, Demetrius, did you have a listener question that you're sitting on?
Ooh. Yes, I had a question about favorite drills.
Ooh, this should be fun. All right. Rob, would you like to answer it first? Favorite drills, if you have any, or why you don't have any?
Well, I do have one, and that is I would put if it's 8-ball, I would throw out two or three stripes, and then the 8-ball. If it's 10-ball, then I'd 7, 8, 9, 10, and put them in precarious spots on the table, and do your best. You know, try to put three of the balls on a rail, and maybe the last ball I have a rail. You know, see if you can do that. Go from one end of the table to the other, and back to the other end of the table, without letting the pockets get in the way somehow. You know, that kind of a drill, because that happens in matches.
Yeah.
I mean, you got to go up from the rail on one side of the short rail to the other short rail, and then back up. And, so that's a kind of a drill I would use, especially before a tournament of some type.
One thing I love about that, and one little variant on that, what I like to do sometimes there is I'll put like the 7, 8, 9, in a spot where it's like a little bit tricky to get from the 7 to the 8 to the 9.
Yeah.
But instead of taking like ball in hand on the 7, maybe the first few times I do it, I'm like, okay, where do I want to be on the 7? And with ball in hand, can I run these 3? Yeah. But then once I do that a few times, then I'll throw the 5, 6 on the table randomly and take ball in hand on the 5. But I put the 7, 8, 9 in the same spot, but I just throw the 5, 6 in a few different locations. Because sure. Then I have to practice shooting the 5, 6, landing on the 7 in that area that I want to go ahead and execute that 7, 8, 9.
Right.
And then if I get a little full or a little thin, or it might change exactly, or a little longer. So then it's like I keep the 7, 8, 9 in the same spot and just throw out the 5, 6 in different spots and try to run through all 5 balls. Because then once you've kind of worked on that 3-ball trouble spot, then you can work on kind of doing it in a gameplay situation, which is earning the landing on the 7 that you want, as opposed to just getting ball in hand there. So that's a really good call, Rob.
Yeah, it's things that when it comes up in a game, then when it does happen to you, when you see it, you remember, and you go, "Well, I know how to get out of these."
Yeah.
What about you, Nate? What's a good drill?
The drills that I like. I don't really necessarily like those as much as I like. If I'm going to do a drill, it's to work on a particular tool in the game that is underutilized. Or maybe I shouldn't say underutilized, underpracticed. And I know that we throw these words around a lot, and what do they actually mean? But like when you say a stop shot, I mean, most players, you know what a stop shot is, right? But how many people actually spend the time to work on them? The answer is very, very few players will actually set up and practice it. So one of my favorite drills to have my students work on, and every now and then I'll throw it up for myself, especially when I'm trying to get the feel of the tables, I'll do what I call a stop shot train. I put a ball in the corner on the far corner of the table. So I shoot corner to corner. And I always set up on the rack side of things, because then the ball return is right next to you. And what I do is I take 14 balls and I put them next to me, and I take the 15th ball and I put it in the pocket of the top right corner, and then I shoot from the bottom left corner. And what I do is I just basically shoot stop shots. So if you hit it properly, your cue ball should stop one ball length away from where your ball you're shooting into. And what you can basically do then is you can shoot all 14 balls into that corner. Basically, using each time that you shoot one of the balls in, you replace it with a new ball. You shoot that ball in, you replace it with a new ball. You grab another ball, you shoot that one in, you replace it with the same ball. And by the end of it, you actually should end up being just shy of the side pocket. So what you're doing is you're shooting 15 stop shots in different lengths. And if you hit them correctly, of course, you're going to be back by the side pocket. And it's a really, really good way of knowing whether or not you, everybody thinks they can hit a stop shot. And everybody, what I find is everybody knows how to hit a stop shot and they hit a stop shot perfect once. So they think that tool is completely refined and you don't have to worry about it anymore. But what I find with my students when I have them do this is, yes, they might be able to hit 2 out of 3 stop shots perfectly, but the third one they miss completely and they follow the cue ball in, or they draw the cue ball back, you know, 3 or 4 inches. And that's not a stop shot.
Anybody that thinks that it's easy, I was practicing with a student 2 days ago, and they had a hanging ball, and they had to stop the cue ball for a shot on the end rail where they can't follow it in. But if they were short side, the ball was on the end rail near the cue ball, so if they drew back 2 or 3 inches, it would have been a tough cut. They just had to stop from like the head string. And it's like, let me tell you, they did not run those balls. Like, it's all easy until you have to.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it's
I like a drill too, where you can take a coin, say you set a ball up straight in the side, and maybe it's 3 inches out of the side pocket and the cue ball is a foot away. And then you put the coin in different places on the table. And you should be able to pocket that ball and get the cue ball to wherever that coin is, anywhere on the table, and practice that kind of thing. And for just overall cue ball control, getting it to where you want it to go. And that was fun. I enjoyed doing that. You know, see how close I could come to landing. So it taught you not only spin off the rails or draw, but speed and touch.
Yes.
Yep.
So
let me jump in. I still have one more
handful. I've probably got 5 or 10 that are in my Hall of Fame that I just love. But one that it's just the one that's easiest to explain over a podcast without a table. Is the no rail drill, where you spread 15 balls across the table and you spread them out such that no two are near each other. Nothing's within 6 inches of each other. No ball's within 6 inches of another ball, and nothing's within 6 or 8 inches of a rail. So they're all just kind of floating out in space. You get ball in hand and you have to run all 15 balls without allowing the cue ball to contact a rail or another ball.
I like it.
And what's nice about this is this is actually very difficult. I think that I'm probably about 60%, which means and a lot of times, you know, it gets harder as you go, so that once you get down to the last 3-4 balls, you have no backup shots or safety valves, and there's no recovery shots. There's no way if you get bad angles, you just can't recover. You have to stay like kind of where you want to be. And what I like about this is two things. First of all, it demands the right level of focus. Where you can't freewheel through it. You have to be very, very focused and demanding. You have to ask for a lot from yourself, and it really trains the right level of effort in pool. And then the other thing is that it really works on small, wiggly stuff. So, for example, that drill a lot of times is decided by, you know, there's shots where you don't want to stop, but you don't want to roll forward 3 or 4 inches. You just want to rock over a half a cue ball, or you just want to, like, a stop would maybe work, but if you could back it up like an inch or two, that would be really good. Or if, you know, you want to kind of stunt over 2 to 3 inches and just kind of wiggle. It's these really, really short things. And when I watch, like, a big difference between, you know, different levels of play is that when people are just like a stop shot, I can either stop it or I can roll it in. It's like they're missing skills, and there's a lot to be gained by getting good at just wiggling the cue ball an inch or two and kind of rocking it here and, you know, dripping it back there. And it's like, to me, what kind of like what Nate's saying with the stop shot drill. When you're learning pool, there's a period of time where you're learning new shots and you're getting better at those shots. So I like to say that when players are getting good, they have to learn all the shots and they have to develop and improve their skills and their make percentage and their execution and control with all the shots. But what happens is there comes a point where it becomes hard to improve your execution on, you know, high inside three railers or, you know, whatever hard, long draw shots. And so then it's like, first you have to develop all the tools, but then to get to the advanced levels, you have to put most of those tools back on the shelf and try not to use them. And just get, and so the way that you do that is you get really, 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 really good at the easy shots. You get really good at stop shots where you can actually really, like, being able to control the cue ball more accurately on short distances is going to pay off way more than trying to, you know, work on your, you know, your three rail banks or on your, you know what I mean? It just doesn't make any sense. So what happens is if your cue ball is not super tight on these short distances, then your game will always depend on hard shots and you're going to be limited by your make percentage on difficult shots. And you can only improve those things so much. But if you can get in the habit of getting really, really, really sharp with your easy shots, then you can actually keep leaving yourself easy shots to where you never have to shoot shots that are 60-70%. And so that's actually the key to go from like kind of like a good player to a great player. That's why you hear stuff about Moscone running 100 balls and nothing was ever hard. It's right. Like the only way you can run hundreds in straight pool, you just can't be taking 60% shots every rack. It just doesn't happen.
Yeah.
And people that want to go back and watch how I played in the VG10, I'm not like super proud of it. I'm not like that was the way pool should look, but it's like I never really did anything hard. And that's for me how I found a way to be more consistent. So the no rails drill, it demands the right level of focus, and it's all about sharpening up your, you know, improving 2 inches of accuracy on easy shots.
Well, there's a lot of thinking involved in that though too. I mean, before you shoot, which ball to shoot.
And you have to start checking your angles. You can't just fire a ball in and know that you're going to get on the next ball. Then you walk around and you're like, ooh, I guess I have too much angle here. Yeah, so anyway, I went on too far already, but I'm a big believer in that drill. So,
well, that's a good drill. I'm behind you on that 100% because that's going to fine-tune. Like you say, an inch to the left, inch to the right, drop back 2 inches or drop back three. What is that?
And that thing with little Chris, that one where I was kind of hinting about the guy whose first shot was a little loose and then he had a hard rack, he has this 8-ball rack and he ends up making it really hard. It's like looking back, it's like, well, how can he improve as a player? There was no way to run that 8-ball rack that was easy. But if on his first shot, he had to shoot a stripe and billiard into a solid. And if he had billiarded into the wrong part of the solid, where he had to shoot, there was a trouble ball. If he had stunned the cue ball 6 inches and hit the right side of that solid, he would have gotten on his trouble ball, picked it off, and had a routine layup. But instead, he just made his first ball, slammed into the solid, hit the wrong side of it, didn't get a shot at the trouble ball, and the whole runout was so difficult. And now he's asking for advice. He's like, well, how can I get better? It's like, you're never going to get better at making all these trouble shots and cutting balls off the rail past size from awkward angles and all these other things you had to do. The only way to get better is if you demand more from yourself on that first stun shot to where you get on your trouble ball earlier. And what did that come down to? It came down to a 6-inch stun shot and being able to cheat the tangent line just a little with a little bit more below to where instead of following the actual tangent line, you fudge it backwards just 5 or 10 degrees, hit the other side of that solid. It's like, to me, it's like you can sit there and work on all those other shots for the rest of your life and you're not going to get a lot better. Or you can start getting a little bit more accurate on that one shot, that one time where it's a soft stun going 6 inches on an easy shot. And that's where his rack went offline is a simple shot that led to all these recoveries. So, okay.
Yep.
Yeah, that's a great point, Demi.
Yep. All right. Well, I have prior arrangements, so I got to nip this in the butt right now because I have another podcast I got to do right after this one, which is starting up very quickly. So I think that's a good place to leave this podcast for today. I'll thank you guys for joining me, and please tune in to the VG10 that's starting on the 1st. We probably
next
won't
Monday.
Get a, yes, we probably will not get
what
another
time?
Podcast out until then.
What time next Monday?
Well, we start at
Central Standard Time.
Central Standard Time. Let me answer that question once I see the bracket. The answer to your question, as I stall for a little while longer, is at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, so 10 a.m. Central Time on February 1st.
And
the
what time will Demetrius play?
Well, the second match will follow immediately after the match one. Match three will be on February 2nd. And that will be at 11 a.m. And that will be
Tuesday at 11. Demetrius.
Yeah. Well, a week from now, I'm going to be watching Mika just go on a complete tear. Good for me. I'm looking forward to it.
Okay, and, call me, Nate, so I watch that one. Yeah.
Why can't you just set an alarm? I know the answer to that. I know the answer to that. Yeah, I know the answer to that. All right, well, let's leave it there. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Till next time.
All right, take care, everybody.
Until next time, folks.
Hey everyone, thanks again for listening. If you've liked what you've heard and you want to contribute to the future content that will be made, consider joining the podcast's Patreon at www.patreon.com/queueitup. Becoming a Patreon of the podcast will help to create all of the future content that the podcast will have. Special shout out to Dave Peters, Aaron Taylor, Pete Silsby, Morgan Lupton, Ben Young, Robert Miller, Andy Morse, and Bill Pelham for your generous contributions to the podcast's Patreon. If you ever need any more information on what the Patreon system is or how you can contribute outside of the Patreon, please reach out to the podcast or Nate himself. If you would like to contribute to the podcast for free, consider sharing any podcasts or the podcast page on Facebook itself. Also, leaving a review and a rating if you listen through iTunes. It helps others find the podcast. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back soon with another episode of the Cue It Up podcast.